My Babsk has been eager to speak with you.
He glanced at Mem.
Is that my Azish cavalry lord's suit?
Yes.
You got the aether out of it?
What?
He strolled over and pulled the red trousers out of the basket to inspect them.
Mem, you are an absolute genius. Not every hunter carries a spear, and this is proof indeed. Go to Condwish and tell him I approve a 3 firemark bonus for you.
Thank you, Marais.
Go collect your bonus and leave, Marais said. Note that you will need to find a new wash girl to help you after today.
Interlude 9. True Labor Begins.
Esh and I would have loved this, Venli thought, as she flew hundreds of feet in the air. Rhine and the other fused carried her by means of linked harnesses. It made her feel like a sack of grain being hauled to market, but it gave her quite an amazing view. Endless hills of stone, patches of green, often in the shadows of hillsides, thick forests snarled with undergrowth to present a unified front against the storms. Esh and I would have been thrilled. She'd have begun drawing maps, talking about the places she could go. Venli, on the other hand, spent most of these trips feeling sick to her stomach. Normally she didn't have to suffer for long. Towns were close together here in Alethkar. Yet today her ancestors flew her past many occupied towns without stopping. Eventually, what first appeared to be another ridge of stones resolved into the walls of a large city, easily twice the size of one of the domes at the Shattered Plains. Stone buildings and reinforced towers. Marvels and wonders. It had been years since she'd seen Kolinar, only that once, when they'd executed King Gavilar. Now smoke rose in patches throughout the city, and many of the guard towers had been shattered. The city gates lay broken. Kolinar, it seemed, had been conquered. Rhine and his companions zipped through the air, raising fists toward other fused. They surveyed the city, then soared out beyond the wall and landed near a bunker outside the city. They waited as Venli undid her harness, then lifted into the air again just high enough that the bottoms of their long cloaks brushed the stones.
"Am I finished with my work, Ancient One?" Venli asked to subservience. "Is that why you finally brought me here?"
"Done," Rhine said to ridicule. "Child, you haven't even begun. Those little villages were practice. Today your true labor begins."
Interlude 10. Sheeler.
"You have 3 choices," the Herdazian general said.
He had dark brown skin, the color of a weathered stone, and there was a hint of gray in the thin mustache on his upper lip. He stepped up to Sheeler, then put his hands to his sides. Remarkably, some men affixed manacles to the general's own wrists. "What on Roshar?"
"Pay attention," the general said. "This is important."
"To the manacles," Sheeler said in Herdazian. Life on the border had forced him to learn the language.
"What is going on here? Do you realize the trouble you're in for taking me captive?"
Sheeler started to stand, but one of the Herdazian soldiers forced him down so hard his knees rapped against the hard stone floor of the tent.
"You have 3 choices."
The general's manacles clinked as he twisted his hands in them.
"First, you can choose the sword. Now that might be a clean death. A good beheading rarely hurts. Unfortunately, it won't be a headsman who gets the chance with you. We'll give the sword to the women you abused. Each gets a hack, one after another. How long it goes on will depend on them."
"This is outrageous," Sheeler said. "I'm a Light Eyes of the 5th Dawn. I'm cousin to the High Lord himself and..."
"Second option," the general said. is the hammer. We break your legs and arms, then hang you from the cliff by the ocean. You might last until the storm that way, but it will be miserable.
Sheila struggled to no avail. Captured by Herdazians. Their general wasn't even a light eyes. The general twisted his hands, then pulled them apart. The manacles clinked to the ground. Nearby, several of his officers grinned while others groaned. A scribe had tapped off the time and gave an accounting of the seconds the escape had taken. The general accepted the applause of several men, then thumped another, a loser in the betting, on his back. Sheila almost seemed forgotten for a moment. Finally, the general turned back to him.
"I wouldn't take the hammer if I were you. But there's a third option. The hog."
"I demand the right of ransom," Sheila said. "You must contact my High Prince and accept payment based on my rank."
"Ransom is for men caught in battle," the general said. "Not bastards caught robbing and murdering civilians."
"My homeland is under invasion," Sheila shouted. "I was gathering resources so we might mount a resistance."
"A resistance is not what we caught you mounting."
The general kicked at the manacles by his feet.
"Choose one of the three options. I don't have all day."
Sheila licked his lips. How had he ended up in this situation? His homeland gone crazy, the parshmen rampaging, his men scattered by flying monsters? Now this? The dirty Herdazians obviously weren't going to listen to reason. They... Wait.
"Did you say hog?"
Sheila asked.
"It lives down by the shore," the Herdazian general said. "That's your third option. We grease you, then you wrestle the hog. It's fun for the men to watch. They need sport now and then."
"And if I do this, you won't kill me?"
"No. But this isn't as easy as you think. I've tried it myself, so I can speak with authority."
"Crazy Herdazians."
"I choose the hog."
"As you wish."
The general picked up the manacles and handed them to his officer.
"Thought you'd fail these ones for sure," the officer said. "The merchant claimed they're from the best Thalen locksmiths." "Doesn't matter how good the lock is, Gerano," the general said with a grin, "if the cuffs are loose."
What a ridiculous little man. Too wide smile, a flat nose, a missing tooth. Why, High Lord Amaram would have... Sheila was jerked to his feet by the chains, then pulled through the camp of Herdazian soldiers on the Alethi border. There were more refugees here than actual fighting men. Give Sheila a single company, and he could rout this entire force. His insufferable captors led him down an incline past the cliffs and toward the shore. Soldiers and refugees alike gathered above, jeering and calling. Obviously, the Herdazian general was too frightened to actually kill an Alethi officer, so they would humiliate him by making him wrestle a pig. They'd have a good laugh, then send him away smarting. Idiots. He'd come back with an army. One man locked Sheila's chain to a metal loop on the stones. Another approached with a pitcher of oil. They poured it over Sheila's head. He sputtered as the liquid ran down his face.
"What is that stench?"
Above, someone blew a horn.
"I'd say good luck, boss," the Herdazian soldier told Sheila as his companion ran off. "But I've got 3 marks on you, not lost in a full minute. Still, who knows? When the general was chained down here, he got out in less."
The ocean started to churn.
"Of course," the soldier said. "The general likes this kind of thing. He's a little weird."
The soldier dashed back up the bank, leaving Sheila locked in place, doused in pungent oil and gaping as an enormous claw broke the surface of the ocean. Perhaps the hog was more of a nickname.
Interlude 11. Her Reward. Venli's little spren, whom she'd named Timber, peeked around the room, looking in each corner and shadowed place,
like she did each time Venli let her out of the pouch. Days had passed since Venli had first arrived at Kolinar, and as Rhine had warned, this was her true labor. Venli now gave her presentation a dozen times each day, speaking to groups of singers brought out of the city for the purpose. She wasn't allowed into Kolinar herself. They kept her sequestered in this storm shelter outside, which they called the Hermitage. Venli hummed to spite as she leaned against the window, annoyed by the incarceration. Even the window had only been installed, cut by a shard blade and set with thick storm shutters, after her repeated requests. The city outside called to her. Majestic walls, beautiful buildings. It reminded her of Narak, which actually her people hadn't built. In living there, the listeners had profited from the labors of ancient humans, as modern humans had profited from the enslaved singers. Timber floated over to her, then hovered by the window, as if to sneak out and look around outside. "No," Venli said. Timber pulsed to resolve, then inched forward in the air. "Stay inside," Venli said to command. "They're watching for Spren like you. Descriptions of your kind and others have been spread all through the city." The little Spren backed away, pulsing to annoyance, before settling in the air beside Venli. Venli rested her head on her arms. "I feel like a relic," she whispered. "Already I seem like a cast-off ruin from a nearly forgotten day. Are you the reason I feel like that suddenly? I only get this way when I let you out." Timber pulsed to peace. Upon hearing that, something stirred deep within Venli, the void Spren that occupied her gem heart. That Spren couldn't think, not like Ulim or the higher void Spren. It was a thing of emotions and animal instincts, but the bond with it granted Venli her form of power. She started to wonder. So many of the fused were obviously unhinged. Perhaps their inordinately long lives had taken a toll on their psyches. Wouldn't Odium need new leaders for his people? If she proved herself, could she claim a place among them? New fused. New gods? Esh and I had always worried about Venli's thirst for power, and had cautioned her to control her ambitions. Even Demid at times had been worried for her. And now they were all dead. Timber pulsed to peace, then to pleading, then back to peace. "I can't," Venli said to mourning. "I can't." Pleading, more insistent, the rhythm of the lost, of remembrance, and then pleading. "I'm the wrong one," Venli said to annoyance. "I can't do this, Timber. I can't resist him." Pleading. "I made this happen," she said to Fury. "Don't you realize that? I'm the one who caused all this. Don't plead to me." The Spren shrank, her light diminishing, yet she still pulsed to resolve. "Idiot Spren." Venli put a hand to her head. Why was she not more angry about what had happened to Demid, Eshenai, and the others? Could Venli really think about joining the Fused? Those monsters insisted her people were gone and rebuffed her questions about the thousands of listeners who had survived the Battle of Narak. Were they all being turned into Fuse? Shouldn't Venli be thinking about that? Not her ambitions? "A form changes the way you think, Venli." Everyone knew that. Esh and I had lectured incessantly, as had been her way, about not letting the form dictate one's actions. Control the form, don't let it control you. But then Esh and I had been exemplary. A general and a hero, Esh and I had done her duty. All Venli had ever wanted was power. Timber suddenly pulsed with a flash of light and zipped away under the bed, terrified. Ah, Venli said to morning, looking past the city at the sudden darkening of the sky. The Everstorm. It came about every 9 days, and this was the second since her arrival. So that's why they didn't bring an evening batch to listen to me. She folded her arms, took a deep breath, and hummed to resolve, until she lost track and shifted unconsciously to the rhythm of destruction. She didn't close the window. He didn't like that. Instead, she closed her eyes and listened to the thunder. Lightning flashed beyond her eyelids, red and garish. The spren in her leaped to feel it, and she grew excited, the rhythm of destruction swelling inside her. Her people might be gone, but this power was worth it. How could she not embrace this? How long can you keep being two people, Venli? She seemed to hear Eshenai's voice. How long will you vacillate? The storm hit, wind blasting through the window, lifting her, and she entered some kind of vision. The building vanished, and she was tossed about in the storm, but she knew that after it passed, she wouldn't be hurt. Venli eventually dropped onto a hard surface. She hummed to destruction and opened her eyes, finding herself standing on a platform hanging high in the sky, far above Roshar, which was a blue and brown globe below. Behind her was a deep black nothingness, marred only by a tiny blip that could have been a single star. That yellow-white star expanded toward her at an awesome speed, swelling, growing, until it overwhelmed her with an incredible flame. She felt her skin melting, her flesh burning away.
"You are not telling the story well enough," Odium's voice declared, speaking the ancient tongue. "You grow restless. The fused inform me of it. This will change, or you will be destroyed."
Yes, Lord.
Speaking burned away her tongue. She could no longer see. The fire had claimed her eyes. Pain, agony. But she couldn't bend to it, for the god before her demanded all of her attention. The pain of her body being consumed was nothing compared to him.
"You are mine. Remember this."
She was vaporized completely. And woke. On the floor of her hermitage, fingers bleeding from having clawed the stone again. The storm's rumbling had grown distant. She'd been gone for hours. Had she burned the entire time? Trembling, she squeezed her eyes shut, her skin melting, her eyes, her tongue burning away. The rhythm of peace pulled her out of it, and she knew Timber hovered beside her. Venli rolled over and groaned, eyes still shut, seeking peace in her own mind. She couldn't find it. Odium's presence was too fresh. The spren inside her thrummed to craving instead.
"I can't do it," she whispered to derision. "You've got the wrong sister."
The wrong sister had died. The wrong sister lived. Venli had schemed to return their gods. This was her reward.
Part 4. Defy. Sing Beginnings. Adolin, Shallan, Kaladin, Dalinar, Navani, Zeth, Taravangian, Venli. 88. Voices. 8 years ago. Gavilar was starting to look worn. Dalinar stood at the back of the king's den, listening with half an ear. The king spoke with the heirs of the high princes, staying to safe topics, like Gavilar's plans for various civic projects in Kolinar. "He's looking so old," Dalinar thought. "Gray before his time. He needs something to revitalize him. A hunt, maybe?" Dalinar didn't need to participate in the meeting. His job was to loom. Occasionally, one of the younger men would glance toward the perimeter of the room and see the blackthorn there in shadow. watching. He saw fires reflected in their eyes and heard the weeping of children in the back of his mind. Don't be weak, Dalinar thought. It's been almost 3 years. 3 years, living with what he'd done. 3 years wasting away in Kolinar. He'd assumed it would get better. It was only getting worse. Sadeas had carefully spun news of the rift's destruction to the king's advantage. He'd called it regrettable that the rifters had forced Kolin action by killing Dalinar's wife, and named it unfortunate that the city had caught fire during the fighting. Gavilar had publicly censured Dalinar and Sadeas for losing the city to flames, but his denunciation of the rifters had been far more biting. The implication was clear. Gavilar didn't want to unleash the Blackthorn. Even he couldn't predict what kind of destruction Dalinar would bring. Obviously, such measures were a last resort, and these days everyone was careful to give him plenty of other options. So efficient. All it had cost was one city, and possibly Dalinar's sanity. Gavilar suggested to the gathered light eyes that they light a fire in the hearth for warmth. Well, that was the signal that he could leave. Dalinar could not stand fire. The scent of smoke smelled like burning skin, and the crackling of flames reminded him only of her. Dalinar slipped out the back door, stepping into a hallway on the third floor, heading toward his own rooms. He had moved himself and his sons into the royal palace. His own keep reminded him too much of her. Storms, standing in that room looking at the fear in the eyes of Gavilar's guests, had made the pain and memories particularly acute today. He was better on some days. Others felt like today. He needed a stiff drink from his wine cabinet. Unfortunately, as he rounded through the curved corridor, he smelled incense in the air. Coming from his rooms? Anarn was burning it again. Dalinar pulled up as if he'd run up against something solid, then turned on his heel and walked away. It was too late, unfortunately. That scent, that was her scent. He strode down to the second floor, passing blood-red carpets, pillared hallways. Where to get something to drink? He couldn't go out into the city where people acted so terrified of him. The kitchens? No, he wouldn't go begging to one of the palace chefs, who would in turn tiptoe to the king and whisper that the Blackthorn had been at the Violets again. Gavilar complained at how much Dalinar drank, but what else did soldiers do when not at war? Didn't he deserve a little relaxation after all he'd done for this kingdom? He turned toward the king's throne room, which, as the king was using his den instead, would be empty today. He went in through the servants' entrance and stepped into a small staging room where food was prepared before being delivered to the king. Using a sapphire sphere for light, Dalinar knelt and rummaged in one of the cupboards. Usually they kept some rare vintages here for impressing visitors. The cupboards were empty. Damnation. He found nothing but pans, trays, and cups. A few bags of Herdazian spices. He fumed, tapping the counter. Had Gavilar discovered that Dalinar was coming here and moved the wine? The king thought him a drunkard, but Dalinar indulged only on occasion. On bad days. Drink quieted the sounds of people crying in the back of his mind. Weeping. Children burning. Begging their fathers to save them from the flames. And Irby's voice accompanying them all. When was he going to escape this? He was becoming a coward. Nightmares when he tried to sleep, weeping in his mind whenever he saw fire, storms take Evie for doing this to him. If she'd acted like an adult instead of a child, if she'd been able to face duty or just reality for once, she wouldn't have gotten herself killed. He stomped into the corridor and strode right into a group of young soldiers. They scrambled to the sides of the hallway and saluted. Dalinar tipped his head toward their salutes, trying to keep the thunder from his expression. The consummate general. That was who he was.
Father?
Dalinar pulled up sharply. He'd completely missed that Adolin was among the soldiers. At 15, the youth was growing tall and handsome. He got the former from Dalinar. Today, Adolin wore a fashionable suit with far too much embroidery and boots that were topped by silver.
"That's not a standard-issue uniform, soldier," Dalinar said to him.
"I know," Adolin said. "I had it specially tailored."
Storms. His son was becoming a fop.
"Father,"
Adolin said, stepping up and making an eager fist.
"Did you get my message? I've got a bat set up with Tenethar. Father, he's ranked. It's a step toward winning my blade."
He beamed at Dalinar. Emotions warred inside of Dalinar. Memories of good years spent with his son in Yakabed, riding or teaching him the sword. Memories of her, the woman from whom Adolin had inherited that blonde hair and that smile. So genuine. Dalinar wouldn't trade Adolin's sincerity for 100 soldiers in proper uniforms. But he also couldn't face it right now.
"Father?"
Adolin said.
"You're in uniform, soldier. Your tone is too familiar. Is this how I taught you to act?"
Adolin blushed, then put on a stronger face. He didn't wilt beneath the stern words. When censured, Adolin only tried harder.
"Sir," the young man said, "I'd be proud if you'd watch my bout this week. I think you'll be pleased with my performance."
Storming child. Who could deny him? "I'll be there, soldier, and we'll watch with pride."
Adolin grinned, saluted, then dashed back to join the others. Dalinar walked off as quickly as he could to get away from that hair, that wonderful, haunting smile. Well, he needed a drink now more than ever, but he would not go begging to the cooks. He had another option, one that he was certain even his brother, sly though Gavilar was, wouldn't have considered. He went down another set of steps and reached the eastern gallery of the palace, now passing ardents with shaved heads. It was a sign of his desperation that he came all the way out here, facing their condemning eyes. He slipped down the stairwell into the depths of the building, entering halls that led toward the kitchens in one direction, the catacombs in the other. A few twists and turns led him out onto the beggar's porch, a small patio between the compost heaps and the gardens. Here a group of miserable people waited for the offerings Gavilar gave after dinner. Some begged of Dalinar, but a glare made the rag-clothed wretches pull back and cower. At the back of the porch he found Ehu, huddled in the shadows between two large religious statues, their backs facing the beggars, their hands spread toward the gardens. Ehu was an odd one, even for a crazy beggar. With black, matted hair and a scraggly beard, his skin was dark for Naleti. His clothing was mere scraps, and he smelled worse than the compost. Somehow, he always had a bottle with him. Ehu giggled at Dalinar.
"Have you seen me?"
Unfortunately, Dalinar settled on the ground.
"I have smelled you, too. What are you drinking today? It better not be water this time, Ehu."
Ehu wagged a stout, dark bottle.
"Do you know what it is, little child? Tastes good."
Dalinar tried a sip and hissed. A burning wine, no sweetness to it at all. A white, though he didn't recognize the vintage. Storms, it smelled intoxicating. Dalinar took a chug, then handed the bottle back to Ehu.
"How are the voices?"
"Soft today. They chant about ripping me apart, eating my flesh, drinking my blood."
"Pleasant."
"Hee
hee." Ehu snuggled back against the branches of the hedge wall as if they were soft silk.
"Nice. Not bad at all, little child. What of your noises?"
In reply, Dalinar reached out his hand. Ehu gave him the bottle. Dalinar drank, welcoming the fuzzing of mind that would quiet the weeping.
"Aven begah," Ehu said. "It's a fine night for my torment, and no telling the skies to be still. Where is my soul, and who is this in my face?"
"You're a strange little man, Ehu."
Ehu cackled his response and waved for the wine. After a drink, he returned it to Dalinar, who wiped off the beggar's spittle with his shirt. Storm Gavilar for pushing him to this.
I like you, Ehu said to Dalinar. I like the pain in your eyes. Friendly pain. Companionable pain.
Thanks.
Which one got you, little child? Ehu asked. The Black Fisher? The Spawning Mother? The Faceless? Moloch is close. I can hear his wheezing, his scratching, his scraping at time like a rat breaking through walls.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Madness, Ehu said, then giggled. I used to think it wasn't my fault, but you know, we can't escape what we did. We let them in. We attracted them, befriended them, took them out to dance and courted them. It is our fault. You open yourself to it and you pay the price. They ripped my brain out and made it dance. I watched.
Dalinar paused, the bottle halfway to his lips. Then he held it out to Ehu.
Drink this. You need it.
Ehu obliged. Sometime later, Dalinar stumbled back to his rooms, feeling downright serene, thoroughly smashed and without a crying child to be heard. At the door, he stopped and looked back down the corridor. Where? He couldn't remember the trip back up from the beggar's porch. He looked down at his unbuttoned jacket, his white shirt stained with dirt and drink. A voice drifted through the closed door. Was that Adolin inside? Dalinar started, then focused. Stormzy'd come to the wrong door. Another voice. Was that Gavilar? Dalinar leaned in. I'm worried about him, Uncle, Adolin's voice said.
Your father never adjusted to being alone, Adolin, the king replied. He misses your mother. Idiots, Dalinar thought. He didn't miss Evie. He wanted to be rid of her. Though he did ache now that she was gone. Was that why she wept for him so often?
He's down with the beggars again, another voice said from inside. Elikar? That little boy? Why did he sound like a man? He was only... how old?
He tried the serving room again first. Seems he forgot he drank that all last time. Honestly, if there's a bottle hidden in this palace anywhere, that drunken fool will find it.
My father is not a fool, Adolin said. He's a great man, and you owe him your...
Peace, Adolin, Gavilar said. Both of you, hold your tongues. Dalinar is a soldier. He'll fight through this. Perhaps if we go on a trip, we can distract him from his loss. Maybe Aesir?
Their voices. He had just rid himself of Evie's weeping, but hearing this dragged her back. Dalinar gritted his teeth and stumbled to the proper door. Inside, he found the nearest couch and collapsed.
Map. A portion of the Sea of Lost Lights. My personal map of the requested area, including notes from previous errands. Top left, Candlemore. I rode that Mandra from here to Celebrant, so you owe me those silver pieces after all. Top right, Kolinar's location in the physical realm. Lower than that, Smolderbrand Channel. I met Smolderbrand, stole this map from her. To the left and below that, the city of Celebrant. Middle left, Ravidzath. Spren fishing is illegal here, but their jail is nicer than most. Lower right, Caretaker of Laughter, avoid at all costs. Lower left, Thalen City's location in the physical realm. I hate the lake that corresponds to Thalena's second largest island.
89. Damnation. My research into the Unmade has convinced me that these things were not simply spirits of the void or nine shadows who moved in the night. They were each a specific kind of spren, endowed with vast powers. From Hesse's Mythica, page 3. Adolin had never bothered imagining what damnation might look like. Theology was for women and scribes. Adolin figured he'd try to follow his calling, becoming the best swordsman he could. The Ardens told him that was enough, that he didn't need to worry about things like damnation. Yet here he was, kneeling on a white marble platform with a black sky overhead, a cold sun, if it could even be called that, hanging at the end of a roadway of clouds. An ocean of shifting glass beads clattering against one another. Tens of thousands of flames, like the tips of oil lamps, hovering above that ocean. And the spren. Terrible, awful spren swarmed in the ocean of beads, bearing a multitude of nightmare forms. They twisted and writhed, howling with inhuman voices. He didn't recognize any of the varieties. "I'm dead," Adolin whispered. "We're dead. And this is damnation." But what of the pretty blue-white spren girl? The creature with the stiff robe and a mesmerizing impossible symbol instead of a head? What of the woman with the scratched-out eyes? And those two enormous spren standing overhead with spears and... Light exploded to Adolin's left. Kaladin Stormblessed, pulling in power, floated into the air. Beads rattled and every monster in the writhing throng turned, as if one, to fixate upon Kaladin.
"Kaladin!" the spren girl shouted. "Kaladin, they feed on Stormlight! You'll draw their attention! Everything's attention!"
"Drey and Scar," Kaladin said. "Our soldiers. Where are they?"
"They're still on the other side,"
Shallan said, standing up beside Adolin. The creature with the twisted head took her arm, steadying her.
"Storms, they might be safer than we are. We're in Shadesmar."
Some of the lights nearby vanished, candles' flames being snuffed out. Many spren swam toward the platform, joining an increasingly large group that churned around it, causing a ruckus in the beads. The majority of them were long eel-like things with ridges along their backs and purple antennae that squirmed like tongues and seemed to be made of thick liquid. Beneath them, deep in the beads, something enormous shifted, causing beads to roll off one another in piles.
"Kaladin," the blue girl shouted, "please."
He looked at her and seemed to see her for the first time. The light vanished from him and he dropped, hard, to the platform. Azure held her thin shard blade, gaze fixed on the things swimming through the beads around their platform. The only one who didn't seem frightened was the strange spren woman with the scratched-out eyes and the skin made of rough cloth. Her eyes, they weren't empty sockets. Instead, she was like a portrait where the eyes had been scraped off. Adolin shivered. "So," he said, "any idea what is happening?"
"We're not dead," Azure growled. "They call this place Shadesmar. It's the realm of thought."
"I peek into this place when I soulcast," Shallan said. "Shadesmar overlaps the real world, but many things are inverted here."
"I passed through it when I first came to your land about a year ago," Azure added. "I had guides then, and I tried to avoid looking at too much crazy stuff."
"Smart," Adolin said. He put his hand to the side to summon his own shard blade. The woman with the scratched eyes stretched her head toward him in an unnatural way, then screeched with a loud, piercing howl. Adolin stumbled away, nearly colliding with Shallan and her... her spren? Was that Pattern?
"That is your sword,"
Pattern said in a perky voice. He had no mouth that Adolin could see.
"She is quite dead. I don't think you can summon her here."
He cocked his bizarre head, looking at Azure's blade.
"Yours is different. Very curious."
The thing deep beneath their platform shifted again.
"That is probably bad," Pattern noted. "Yes. Those spren above us are the souls of the Oathgate, and that one deep beneath us is likely one of the Unmade. It must be very large on this side."
"So what do we do?"
Shallan asked. Pattern looked in one direction, then the other.
"No boat.
Yes, that is a problem, isn't it?
Adolin spun around. Some of the eel-like Spren climbed onto the platform using stumpy legs that Adolin had missed earlier. Those long purple antennae stretched toward him, wiggling. Fear Spren, he realized. Fear Spren were little globs of purple goo that looked exactly like the tips of those antennae.
We need to get off this platform, Shallan said. Everything else is secondary. Kaladin?
She trailed off as she glanced toward him. The bridgeman knelt on the stone, head bowed, shoulders slumped. Storms. Adolin had been forced to carry him away from the battle, numb and broken. Looked like that emotion had caught up to him again. Kaladin's Spren, Adolin could only guess that was the identity of the pretty girl in blue, stood beside him, one hand resting protectively on his back.
Kaladin's not well, she said.
I have to be well, Kaladin said,
his voice hoarse as he climbed back to his feet. His long hair fell across his face, obscuring his eyes. Storms. Even surrounded by monsters, the bridgeman could look intimidating.
How do we get to safety? I can't fly us without attracting attention.
This place is the inverse of your world, Azure said.
She stepped back from a long antenna exploring in her direction.
Where there are larger bodies of water on Roshar, we will have land here, correct?
Pattern said, nodding. The river? Adolin asked. He tried to orient himself, looking past the thousands of floating lights.
There.
He pointed at a lump he could barely spot in the distance, like a long island. Kaladin stared at it, frowning.
Can we swim in these beads?
No, Adolin said, remembering what it had felt like to fall into this ocean. The beads rattled and clacked against one another as the large thing surged beneath. In the near distance, a single spire of rock broke the surface, tall and black. It emerged like a mountain peak, slowly lifting from the sea, beads rattling in waves around it. As it grew to the height of a building, a joint appeared. Storms, it wasn't a spire or a mountain, it was a claw. More emerged in other directions. An enormous hand was reaching slowly upward through the glass beads. Deep beneath them, a heartbeat began sounding, rattling the beads. Adolin stumbled back, horrified, and nearly slipped into the bead ocean. He kept his balance, barely, and found himself face to face with a woman with scratches for eyes. She stared at him, completely emotionless, as if waiting for him to try to summon his shard blade so she could scream again.
Damnation.
No matter what Azure said, he was certainly in damnation.
What do I do? Shallan whispered. She knelt on the white stone of the platform, searching among the beads. Each gave her an impression of an object in the physical realm, a dropped shield, a vase from the palace, a scarf. Nearby, hundreds of little Spren, like little orange or green people only a few inches tall, were climbing among the spheres. She ignored those, searching for the soul of something that would help.
Shallan, Pattern said, kneeling. I don't think soul casting will accomplish anything. It will change an object in the other realm, but not here.
What can I do here? Those spines or claws or whatever rose around them, inevitable, deadly. Pattern hummed, hands clasped before him. His fingers were too smooth, as if they were chiseled of obsidian. His head shifted and changed, going through its sequence. The spherical mass was never the same, yet somehow still always felt like him.
My memory, he said. I don't remember.
Stormlight, Shallan thought. Yasna had told her to never enter Shadesmar without Stormlight. Shallan pulled a sphere from her pocket. She still wore Vale's outfit. The beads nearby reacted, trembling and rolling toward her.
Pattern said. Dangerous.
I doubt staying here will be better, Shallan said. She sucked in a little stormlight,
only one mark's worth. As before, the Spren didn't seem to notice her use of Stormlight, as much as they had Kaladin's. She rested her free hand against the surface of the ocean. Beads stopped rolling, and instead clicked together beneath her hand. When she pushed down, they resisted. Good first step, she thought, drawing in more Stormlight. The beads pressed around her hand, gathering, rolling onto one another. She cursed, worried that she'd soon just have a big pile of beads. Shallan, Pattern said, poking at one of the beads. Perhaps this? It was the soul of the shield she'd felt earlier. She moved the sphere to her gloved safe hand, then pressed her other hand to the ocean. She used that bead's soul as a guide, much like she used a memory as a guide for doing a sketch. And the other beads obediently rolled together and locked into place, forming an imitation of the shield. Pattern stepped out onto it, then jumped up and down happily. Her shield held him without sinking, though he seemed as heavy as an ordinary person. Good enough. Now she just needed something big enough to hold them all. Preferably, as she considered, two somethings. You, Sword Lady, Shallan said, pointing at Azure. Help me over here. Adolin, you too. Kaladin, see if you can brood this place into submission. Azure and Adolin hurried over. Kaladin turned, frowning. What? Don't think about that haunted look in his eyes, Shallan thought. Don't think about what you've done in bringing us here, or how it happened. Don't think, Shallan. Her mind went blank, like it did in preparation for drawing, then locked onto her task. Find a way out. Everybody, she said. Those flames are the souls of people, while these spheres represent the souls of objects. Yes, there are huge philosophical implications in that. Let's try to ignore them, shall we? When you touch a bead, you should be able to sense what it represents. Azure sheathed her shard blade and knelt, feeling at the spheres. I can... Yes. There's an impression to each one. We need the soul of something long and flat. Shallan plunged her hands into the spheres, eyes closed, letting the impressions wash over her. I can't sense anything, Adolin said. What am I doing wrong? He sounded overwhelmed, but don't think about that. Look, fine clothing that hadn't been taken out of its trunk in a long, long time, so old that it saw the dust as part of itself. Withering fruit that understood its purpose, decompose, and stick its seeds to the rock, where they could hopefully weather storms long enough to sprout and gain purchase. Swords, recently swung and glorying in their purpose fulfilled. Other weapons belonged to dead men. Blades that had the faintest inkling that they'd failed, somehow. Living souls bobbed around, a swarm of them entering the Oathgate control chamber. One brushed Shallan. Drey the bridge man. For a brief moment she felt what it was like to be him. Worried for Kaladin. Panicked that nobody was in charge, that he would have to take command. He wasn't a commander. You couldn't be a rebel if you were in charge. He liked being told what to do. That way he could find a method to do it with style. Drey's worries caused her own to bubble up. The Bridgeman's powers will fade without Kaladin, she thought. What of Vatha, Red, and Ishna? I didn't focus. Something reached out from the back of her mind, grabbed those thoughts and feelings, and yanked them into the darkness. Gone. She brushed a bead with her fingers. A large door, like a keep's gate. She grabbed the sphere and shifted it to her safe hand. Unfortunately, the next bead she touched was the palace itself. Momentarily stunned by the majesty of it, Shallan gaped. She held the entire palace in her hand. Too large, she dropped it, and kept searching. Trash that still saw itself as a child's toy. A goblet that had been made from melted down nails, taken from an old building. There! She seized hold of a sphere and pressed Stormlight into it. A building rose before her, made entirely out of beads, a copy of the Oathgate control building. She managed to make its top rise only a few feet above the surface, most of the building sinking into the depths. The rooftop was in reach. On top of it! She shouted. She held the replica in place as Pattern scrambled onto the roof. Adolin followed, trailed by that ghostly Spren and Azure. Finally, Kaladin picked up his pack and walked with his Spren onto the rooftop. Shallan joined them with the aid of a hand from Adolin. She clutched the sphere that was the soul of the building and tried to make the bead structure move through the sea like a raft. It resisted, sitting there motionless. Well, she had another plan. She scurried to the other side of the roof and stretched down, held by Pattern, to touch the sea again. She used the soul of the large door to make another standing platform. Pattern jumped down, followed by Adolin and Azure. Once they'd all piled precariously on the door, Shallan let go of the building. It crashed down behind them, beads falling in a tumult, frightening some of the little green Spren crawling among the beads nearby. Shallan reconstructed the building on the other side of the door with only the rooftop showing. They filed across. They progressed like that, following building with door and door with building, inching toward that distant land. Each iteration took Stormlight, though she could reclaim some from each creation before it collapsed. Some of the eel-like Spren with the long antennae followed them, curious. But the rest of the varieties, and there were dozens, let them pass without much notice.
Pattern said. Much emotion on the other side. Yes, this is good. It distracts them.
The work was tiring and tedious, but step by step, Shallan moved them away from the frothing mess of the city of Kolinar. They passed the frightened lights of souls, the hungry Spren, who feasted on the emotions from the other side.
Pattern whispered to her. Look, Shallan, the lights of souls are no longer disappearing. People must be surrendering in Kolinar. I know you do not like the destruction of your own.
That was good, but not unexpected. The Parshmen had never massacred civilians, though she couldn't say for certain what happened to Azure's soldiers. She hoped fervently they were able to either escape or surrender. Shallan had to edge her group frighteningly close to two of the spines that had emerged from the depths. Those gave no sign of having noticed them. Beyond, they reached a calmer space, out among the beads, a place where the only sound came from the clacking of glass.
She corrupted them, Kaladin Spren whispered.
Shallan took a break, wiping her brow with a handkerchief from her satchel. They were distant enough that the lights of souls in Kolinar were just a general haze of light.
What was that, Spren? Azure asked. Corrupted?
That's why we're here. The Oathgate. Do you remember those two Spren in the sky? Those two are the Gateway's soul. But the red coloring. They must be his now. That's why we ended up here instead of going to Urethiru.
Ja'anat, Shallan thought, said she was supposed to kill us, but that she'd try not to. Shallan wiped her brow again, then got back to work.
Adolin felt useless. All his life he had understood. He'd taken easily to dueling. People naturally seemed to like him. Even in his darkest moment, standing on the battlefield and watching Sadeus's armies retreat, abandoning him and his father, he'd understood what was happening to him. Not today. Today he was just a confused little boy standing in damnation. Today, Adolin Colin was nothing. He stepped onto another copy of the door. They had to huddle together while Shallan dismissed the rooftop behind, sending it crashing down, then squeezed past everyone to raise another copy of the building. Adolin felt small, so very small. He started toward the rooftop. Kaladin, however, remained standing on the door, staring sightlessly. Syl, his spren, tugged his hand. "Kaladin?" Adolin asked. Kaladin finally shook himself and gave in to Syl's prodding. He walked onto the rooftop. Adolin followed, then took Kaladin's pack, deliberately but firmly, and swung it over his own shoulder. Kaladin led him. Behind, the doorway shattered back into the ocean of beads. "Hey," Adolin said. "It will be all right." "I survived Bridge 4," Kaladin growled. "I'm strong enough to survive this."
"I'm pretty sure you could survive anything. Storms, Bridge Boy. The Almighty used some of the same stuff he put into shard blades when he made you."
Kaladin shrugged, but as they walked onto the next platform, his expression grew distant again. He stood while the rest of them moved on, almost like he was waiting for their bridge to dissolve and dump him into the sea.
"I couldn't make them see," Kaladin whispered. "I
couldn't protect them. I'm supposed to be able to protect people, aren't I?"
"Hey," Adolin said. "You really think that strange spren with the weird eyes is my sword?"
Kaladin started and focused on him, then scowled.
"Yes, Adolin. I thought that was clear."
"I was just wondering."
Adolin glanced over his shoulder and shivered.
"What do you think about this place? Have you ever heard of anything like it?"
"Do you have to talk right now, Adolin?"
"I'm frightened. I talk when I'm frightened."
Kaladin glared at him as if suspecting what Adolin was doing.
"I know little of this place," he finally answered, "but I think it's where spren are born."
Adolin kept him talking. As Shallan created each new platform, Adolin would lightly touch Kaladin on the elbow or shoulder, and the bridgeman would step forward. Kaladin's spren hovered nearby, but she let Adolin guide the conversation. Slowly, they approached the strip of land, which turned out to be made of a deep, glassy black stone, kind of like obsidian. Adolin got Kaladin across onto the land, then settled him with his spren. Azure followed, her shoulders sagging. In fact, her hair was fading. It was the strangest thing. Adolin watched it dim from a lethy jet black to a faint gray as she sat down. Must be another effect of this strange place. How much did she know of Shadesmar? He'd been so focused on Kaladin, he hadn't thought to interrogate her. Unfortunately, he was so tired right now, he was having trouble thinking straight. Adolin stepped back onto the platform as Pattern stepped off. Shallan looked as if she was about to collapse. She stumbled, and the platform ruptured. He managed to grab her, and fortunately, they only fell to waist-deep in the beads before their feet touched ground. The little balls of glass seemed to slide and move too easily, not supporting their weight. Adolin had to practically haul Shallan through the tide of beads up onto the bank. There, she toppled backward, groaning and closing her eyes. "Shallan?" he asked, kneeling beside her.
"I'm fine. It just took concentration. Visualization."
"We need to find another way back to our world," Kaladin said, seated nearby. "We can't rest. They're fighting. We need to help them."
Adolin surveyed his companions. Shallan lay on the ground, her spren had joined her, lying in a similar posture and looking up at the sky. Azure slumped forward, her small shard blade across her lap. Kaladin continued to stare at nothing with haunted eyes, his spren hovering behind him, worried.
"Azure," Adolin said, "is it safe here, on this land?"
"As safe as anywhere in Shadesmar," she said tiredly. "The place can be dangerous if you attract the wrong spren, but there isn't anything we can do about that."
"Then we camp here."
"But,"
Kaladin said,
"we camp,"
Adolin said, gentle but firm.
"We can barely stand up straight, bridgeman."
Kaladin didn't argue further. Adolin scouted up the bank, though each step felt like it was weighted with stone. He found a small depression in the glassy stone and, with some urging, got the rest of them to move to it.
As they made their improvised beds from their coats and packs, Adolin looked one last time at the city, standing witness to the fall of his birthplace. Storms, he thought. Elokar. Elokar is dead. Little Gav had been taken, and Dalinar was planning to abdicate. Third in line was Adolin himself. King. 90. Reborn. I have done my best to separate fact from fiction, but the two blend like mixing paint when the Voidbringers are involved. Each of the Unmade has a dozen names, and the powers ascribed to them range from the fanciful to the terrifying. From Hesse's Mythica, page 4. Zeth, Sun Sun. Zeth, Sun. Zeth, Truthless. Zeth. Just Zeth. Zeth of Shinovar, once called the Assassin in White, had been reborn. Mostly. The Skybreakers whispered of it. Nin, Herald of Justice, had restored him following his defeat in the storm. Like most things, death had not been Zeth's to claim. The Herald had used a type of Fabriel to heal his body before his spirit departed. It had almost taken too long, however. His spirit hadn't properly reattached to his body. Zeth walked with the others out onto the stone field before their small fortress which overlooked the Pure Lake. The air was humid, almost like that of his homeland, though it didn't smell earthy or alive. It smelled of seaweed and wet stone. There were five other hopefuls, all of them younger than Zeth. He was shortest among them and the only one who kept his head bald. He couldn't grow a full head of hair, even if he didn't shave it. The other five kept their distance from him. Perhaps it was because of the way he left a glowing afterimage when he moved, a sign of his soul's improper reattachment. Not all could see it, but these could. They were close enough to the surges. Or maybe they feared him because of the black sword in a silver sheath that he wore strapped to his back.
"Oh, it's the lake,"
the sword said in his mind. It had an eager voice that didn't sound distinctly feminine or masculine.
"You should draw me, Zeth. I would love to see the lake. Vasha says there are magic fish here. Isn't that interesting?"
"I have been warned, Sword Nimi," Zeth reminded the weapon, "not to draw you except in the case of extreme emergency, and only if I carry much stormlight, lest you feed upon my soul."
"Well, I wouldn't do that,"
the sword said. It made a huffing sound.
"I don't think you're evil at all, and I only destroy things that are evil."
The sword was an interesting test given him by Nin the Herald, called Nale, Nalan, or Naku by most stonewalkers. Even after weeks of carrying this black sword, Zeth did not understand what the experience was to teach him. The Skybreakers arranged themselves to watch the hopefuls. There were some 50 here, and that didn't count the dozens who were supposedly out on missions. So many! An entire order of Knights Radiant had survived the recreants and had been watching for the desolation for 2,000 years, constantly replenishing their numbers as others died of old age. Zeth would join them. He would accept their training as Nin had promised him he would receive, then travel to his homeland of Shinovar. There, he would bring justice to the ones who had falsely exiled him.
"Do I dare bring them judgment?" a part of him wondered. "Dare I trust myself with the Sword of Justice?"
The sword replied,
"You? Zeth, I think you're super trustworthy. And I'm a good judge of people."
"I was not speaking to you, Sword Nimi."
"I know, but you were wrong, and so I had to tell you. Hey, the voices seem quiet today. That's nice, isn't it?"
Mentioning it brought the whispers to Zeth's attention.
Nin had not healed Zeth's madness. He'd called it an effect of Zeth's connection to the powers, and said that he was hearing trembles from the spiritual realm, memories of the dead he'd killed. He no longer feared them. He had died and been forced to return. He had failed to join the voices, and now they had no power over him, right? Why, then, did he still weep in the night, terrified? One of the Skybreakers stepped forward. Ki was a golden-haired woman, tall and imposing. Skybreakers clothed themselves in the garb of local lawkeepers, so here, in Marabethia, they wore a patterned shoulder cloak and a colorful skirt-like wrap. Ki wore no shirt, merely a simple cloth tied around her chest.
"Hopefuls," she said in Azish, "you have been brought here because a full Skybreaker has vouched for your dedication and solemnity."
"She's boring," the sword said. "Where did Nale go?"
"You said he was boring too, Sword Nimi," Zeth whispered.
"That's true, but interesting things happen around him. We need to tell him that you should draw me more often."
"Your first training has already been completed," Ki said. "You traveled with the Skybreakers and joined them in one of their missions. You have been elevated and deemed worthy of the first ideal. Speak it. You know the words."
"Vasher always drew me," the sword said, sounding resentful.
"Life before death," Zeth said, closing his eyes. "Strength before weakness. Journey before destination."
The other five belted it out. Zeth whispered it to the voices that called to him from the darkness. Let them see. He would bring justice to those who had caused this. He'd hoped that the first oath would restore his ability to draw upon Stormlight, something he had lost along with his previous weapon. However, when he removed a spear from his pocket, he was unable to access the light.
"In speaking this ideal," Ki said, "you are officially pardoned for any past misdeeds or sins. We have paperwork signed by proper authorities for this region. To progress further among our ranks and to learn the lashings, you will need a master to take you as their squire. Then may you speak the second ideal. From there,